The idea of creation in the Bible says that life is from God at the beginning and that life is sustained by God in a continued creation. It was interesting last week when George Anderson gave his lectures on creation in the Bible, the several accounts of creation, that he also included John 1 and Colossians 1, and that those also are accounts of creation when God sent Jesus into the world, and that his life, death, and resurrection was to restore us to the fullness of life. Another story of creation. We talked yesterday about God demanding our participation in his ongoing creation through the gifts that he's given to each of us. We can't solve all the world's problems, but each of us with our gifts can do something. And if we suddenly demand that all of the world's problems are going to be taken care of, maybe it's because we don't trust in God's ability through his people to work out those problems. Maybe instead of demanding that things should happen immediately, we should get into the business of helping to free each other up so that we really can use our God-given gifts. We talked yesterday about the loss of meaning that people experience until we are involved in the use of our gifts that God's created within us. Those gifts are just bursting to be used in the community of God's world. Until we use those, we experience a guilt that is as big as any guilt of sin that we know. When we're bound up, we're full of anxiety, and that saps us of all of our energy. So we really need to be freed up. And how can we in the church help to free one another up to use the gifts that God has given to us? We talked also about creation being ex nihilo, out of nothing. And that's the way faith comes to us. God creates faith within us. And we talked about how it can be likened onto a cup that God gives to us. And then we go with that empty cup to God and he fills it with believing in him, the cup of faith that he gives to us. And so we pray in the church, increase our faith, and God gives that gift to us. It's not something that we bring to God, a faith that we have made, but it's a gift, and so we ask him to increase that faith. God's Spirit is no other than God, and God is moving in the world, continuing to create, raising up the gifts within us. There's a passage that I struggled over some years ago in Galatians 6. It was read at our service last night. In Galatians 6, 1 and 2, where it speaks of the challenge to bear one another's burdens. I really struggled over that, wondering and praying over, how do we bear one another's burdens? And as I began to pray for God to show me, it seemed that he started answering that all over the place. My husband is a clergyman, and as he worked with people, it seemed that I was near his side often when there were people who were ill in the parish or people that were in grief. And it just seemed that I got involved. And at the same time, I was taking some courses in nursing that were helping me to be more sensitive and learning how to listen. And that was the ministry that I began to do, mostly listening. And I began to realize that it was a very big ministry in itself, to listen to people. And you can just watch people getting freed up when you listen to them, and when you're there with the love of Christ beside them in times of crisis. What I want to do, first of all, is to, through the use of four stories, to tell something about how this happens. What is the biggest barrier for us in the church not to be a healing community? in answer to that question, I would say that the first one is that we're not in touch with our own feelings, and it's threatening to us to listen to other people's feelings. And I want to tell one true story that happened to me, and I think it's a good example. One day, I was with a group of pastors' wives, and this one young woman was beside me, and I could tell that she was very heavy about something. And I simply said to her, you look like you're carrying a heavy load today. And she stepped back to the coat rack, and she put her head down, and she just started sobbing her heart out. We just sort of quietly went to the corner. I put my hand on her shoulder. I could tell that she felt like she shouldn't be crying there. And I just kind of stood in front of her so that it wasn't so obvious. And I said to her, it's okay to cry. And I stood very silently by her for some time with my hand on her shoulder. Silence is another thing we're most usually afraid of. And I gradually learned that, and so I was silent. I let her finish sobbing, and when she finished, she said, I don't know why I cry so easily over this. And I said, what are you referring to? And she said, well, you see, my mother died 6 months ago, and I can't seem to get over this grief. So we sat down and started talking about it, and I asked her if she really had expressed it very much yet, and she said, oh no. And then she said something very interesting to me. She said, and her husband is a pastor in a church there, and she said to me, when this happened to my mother, she said the people were so good about bringing food and sending me cards. But she said, do you know, not one person ever stopped at the house to listen to how I was feeling. Now that's hard, because you've got to have somebody to listen to you when you're in grief. And so we just sat, and she talked and talked and talked and talked about her mother. This is what you have to do when you're in grief. You have to talk about that person, and you need somebody to listen to you. And that takes a lot of time. And, you know, the challenge is, are we willing to spend time, and are we willing to listen? Because we're afraid of listening to someone's feelings, what I think we do is we lay on words instead of listening. And I'll tell you another story about that. One of my very closest friends died untimely of a heart attack. She was my own age and left 5 little children. This was a tremendous grief to me. And I can still remember the Sunday in church when this dear older lady came up to me and tried to console me by saying, well, at least we're very thankful that she's in heaven. And away she went, quickly. And I was so full of grief. I was so in need of somebody putting an arm around me and listening to my feelings. I knew my friend was in heaven, but God only knew how heavy with grief I was feeling. I needed to talk about that. And instead, she laid some words on me and ran. It was with the best intentions, I know. But I think that's also what we do when we're afraid to listen to someone's hurt. We lay quick words on them. And how many times have you heard someone say, oh, I didn't know for sure what I ought to say. Well, maybe nothing. I think sometimes no words are better than a lot of words. Listening is what's needed. Another story about some things to look for when another person's in crisis. One crisis revives an old one. An example of that was a widow in our church was in grief, and one day I just thought, well, I'll just stop and talk to her, just listen. Well, she was so glad to see me, and I did. I just sat down and I just listened to her, and she started talking about her husband who had died. And then a very interesting thing happened. She stopped and just wept and wept and wept. And I waited until she could talk again, until she was ready. And I suspected that's what was happening. There's an old grief here that she's gotten revived with this present grief. And then she said, there's my granddaughter. And I said, do you want to tell me about it? Then she began to tell how this granddaughter, and I knew she'd been out east when this little one was born, began to tell about how that child was brain injured and was retarded. They'd kept it a total secret when they'd come back. They'd never told a soul. It was like it was going to go away. And the death of her husband suddenly had revived this grief that she had not resolved or dealt with or expressed emotion over yet. And so we talked and talked and talked about this granddaughter. And you could just about see by talking about it the release of anxiety and release of some measure of grief anyway. And I'm telling this just as an example of what we need to do for people when they're in grief. And expect if there's an old crisis that hasn't been resolved, it's going to come back when there's a new crisis or a new grief. Another thing to notice is that when somebody's in crisis, we tend to handle that crisis the same way that we handled one once before. And I want to tell you a story that exemplifies that. It was a neighbor, and suddenly the husband announced that he was going to leave this woman. They just had a new baby. I was a very close friend of hers because we were neighbors and had shared so many things. And suddenly this bomb dropped close to us, and my husband was dealing with this and counseling with him. And the grief that hit her, I just knew was going to take a lot of time, and he was hardly going to be able to give all the time that it was going to need. And so I said to her, I want to be your listening post. And anytime you need to talk to somebody, will you promise me that you'll call me or come over if it's morning, noon, or middle of the night? She promised she'd do that, and she did it. And it took hours and hours and hours and hours of listening, which I was glad to do, and I had the time just then. The other thing that happened then was, I know that you handle a crisis the same as you have a history of handling crises. And so I said that to her. You're really in a crisis, and I'd like to know, the last crisis that you had, what happened? Tell me about it. And she said heavily, yes. She said, I had a real crisis when I was in high school, and I took a whole bottle of aspirins. I said, okay, that's probably what you're going to be tempted to do again then. Yes, she said, that or else go to the liquor closet. And so I said, okay, you've promised to come to me anytime that you want to talk, and will you promise me one more thing? And I said, that's anytime you're tempted to go to the aspirin bottle or to the liquor closet, will you come and knock on my door instead, or will you call me on the phone and tell me to come right over? And she said, yes, I'll do that. And it did happen. I was the aspirin bottle in the liquor closet for her. And it was a rewarding experience to be able to be that substitute. And just to make a long story short, just before the divorce was finalized, a whole series of events happened. And those two people are back together again and very happy. And it's been one of those wonderful experiences in life where it was worth giving yourself to somebody. And I want to get, you know, into a real sharing session here, but there's a couple of more things here I want to add first. When someone's in crisis, I don't know if I should say usually, but maybe often, people do not want sympathy because it robs that person of their own abilities of coping. In fact, it can make you very angry if somebody lays a lot of sympathy on you when you're in crisis. And an example of that was a 37-year-old man in our church in St. Peter who had Hodgkin's disease, was terminally ill, and coped with it, I think, better than any person I have ever seen, very honestly coping with such a heavy crisis. And he said to me one Sunday, when I just sat down and talked with him, it was not long before his death, he said to me, "I get so tired of people asking me, how are you, or how are you feeling today?" He said, "I wish that somebody would come up to me sometime and say, 'Gee, you've got a nice sport coat.'" I think it was an example of he was so tired of people's sympathy, and he really was coping so well. And just take that as a clue that sometimes people don't want your sympathy. It inhibits their coping mechanisms. And another thing that I learned from the same person was, and I've learned through nursing too, that one's perception of the problem is more important than the extent of the problem itself. Dale Larson was very close to death, but his perception of his health was in such a good focus that he knew he was going to die, he just didn't know when. He was running a temperature of 102 and 103 every morning, but he went to work every morning until he had to come home and go to bed about 11 o'clock, and gradually the days got shorter and shorter and shorter at work. But his perception overall, I mean, if he could get up and walk, I mean, he perceived that that was a pretty good day for him. And you had to really admire this coping mechanism. He didn't want his children to remember him in bed all the time, children. He wanted to dress up and go to work, even if it was for an hour, and then come home and go to bed for the rest of the day. You had to admire that. His perception of his illness was more important than the extent of his illness. So that's something to keep in mind, too, when a person is in crisis, and to support them in handling it how they need to handle it. In Luke 7, there is a beautiful story of Jesus dealing with the woman who it says was a sinner who came to him. She is the one who washed his feet and anointed them. And the Pharisee says, "Oh, you're dealing with, it's a sinner." Jesus said to his disciples who were around him something very interesting. "Do you see this woman?" And that's the kind of thing I think we're getting at when we think about being a healing community, to really see the person. To be sensitive, to see and sense and feel what's going on inside of that person. And so we have to ask, how can we be involved in healing? The first thing I think we need to do is learn to listen. We need to be in touch with our own feelings, because we can't listen to someone else until we're honest with our own feelings. I think we need to affirm other people. One of the ways that I feel that we can become sensitive to others is by doing things in the church so that we understand how people feel. I went to a group the other day on divorce that was here at Holden, and I listened and I heard a lot of things expressed that day. I feel that I want to go to places like that so that I can understand better where people are coming from and what they're going through, so that I can be sensitive. Maybe that's something we need to do more of in the church, to have people tell what it's like. One of the best LCW programs that I have ever attended was one in which there was a panel
of three women and a moderator. One of the women was single, had never been married. One was a widow, and one was a divorced woman. And those three people told what it feels like. And they told so many things about themselves. The single woman said that now that she was about 50 years old and her parents had died recently, she said, "Since my parents have died, nobody hugs me. And that day I began," she was a parish worker at church, "and every time I saw her, I said, 'Trudy, have you had your hug yet today?' And she almost always said, 'No, not yet.' And then one day she said to me, 'Whenever I see you coming, I always feel good inside because I know I'm going to get a hug.'" And I like that because I don't think you need to just go hugging everybody you see. But when I know there's somebody that needs a hug, I'm happy to do that. I like to hug Eugene Johnson over there. Not that he needs it so much, but you remind me of my father. So it's for me that I do that. I tell you this about this singles program to say that maybe that's something that we could do in the church. Have a panel like that. And you get very sensitive where all these people are coming from, and you almost feel like you've walked in their shoes. One of them said, "To be alone at Christmas time is so hard. I get all this Christmas mail, and I feel like I want to share all this news I get from different people, and there's nobody to share it with. That makes me feel sad inside to know that somebody is lonesome like that." What can we do? How can we help people like that? Then I'd like to just say a few things about affirming people. Everybody can affirm one another. And I might not think that everything about a certain person is so good and I can affirm, but there's always something that we can affirm about everybody, I guess. And, you know, it really feels good to be affirmed. I think that's got something to do with God's good creation. And to just get in the habit of affirming good things that people are and do. It makes you feel good yourself. And then to state honest feelings. We need to be in touch with our own feelings in order to be sensitive to another. One of the ways that we can practice doing that, I think, is with the I message, doing good I messages. Are you all acquainted with that? No? Some are and some aren't. Well, maybe we should take just a couple of minutes to do that. And maybe it would be good to practice that on each other. You start out by saying the condition. And the way to do it is to start out with the word when. I have used the example several times of when a child comes in the house, say you've got a real light living room carpet and they are tracking in mud. And now you could land right on them and say, "Well, you dummy, you." Now, that wouldn't make them feel so good, and they're not going to fess up to it either. They're going to say, "No, my brother did it." So you start out by stating the condition. When you tracked mud in on the carpet. Okay, that's the condition. Then what is the result to me next? Okay, I'm the mom, so I have to wipe it up. I have to clean it up. And then the third thing is the result to me. Then I feel. What do you think?
Angry.
Most likely angry. Okay, the condition, when you track mud in on the floor, then the result to me, then I have to clean it up, then I feel angry. Okay, now you've stated that very clearly and objectively. All right, how do you think the person might react?
Feel sorry.
Okay, they're more apt to feel sorry than if you said, "Well, you dummy, you. Why did you do that again?"
Well, they could say, "Well, that's your problem."
Okay? But this is a way to state feelings honestly. I feel angry. Or, as we were talking the other day, some young fellow said, I wasn't very well prepared for marriage because I've learned I have to be so honest. Okay, I think what he was after was honest with feelings, mostly. And I know that's where I have had the hardest time. It has shown in marriage. I'm a good actress, I guess, with my feelings. I learned that very young, and I think that most of us probably are. We hide our feelings. And to say, you've got a heavy feeling, I really feel sad today. Well, what's it about? Well, you just don't know. But if you keep talking, and if there's somebody that's really caring about you, gradually the whole bit's going to come out. You're going to get it out, and you can look at it. And once you've talked it out, you just feel free. Have you had those experiences? Well, who can be more dear than somebody who comes along and helps to free you up? I think your body works better, your mind works better, you've got energy freed up, and you can go about doing what God intends you to do. And that's what I think we need to do in the church somehow, to help free people up so that they can use the gifts that God has given to us for His ongoing creation. He needs our gifts in use, not bottled up. Does that make sense? So I'm just going to throw it open to you now, and I'm going to ask you, how can we in the church better become a healing community? I want this to be a workshop. We have half an hour left, and I want us to respond to that. Who wants to start?
Okay.
One of the things that we've done in our church is for our women's group, we have a fairly large church, and we've started Bible studies for our women's groups. And last year there was a real interest in a cooking class and also in a knitting class. And I joined the knitting class in January, kind of by default, because the person who was leading it wasn't going to be there, and she knew I knew my right hand from my left, and so she said, go for me, and I did. I found that group of people were very, very open and willing to share, and I sat next to a lady for several weeks in a row who just needed to be listened to, and out of that listening, I became very concerned about her, and had watched for her on Sunday and looked for her at other things. And I say that, you know, knitting classes maybe aren't the ultimate in church relationships, but that was a good experience. And I went to the knitting class partially for myself too, because I enjoy doing things with my hands, and I'm out of it, I'm doing this. But it was because I do a bit of teaching, considerable amount of teaching in our church, I thought this was something I wouldn't need to do a lot of preparation for. I think your point about listening is a great one.
And those opportunities are right beside you all the time.
Interesting, yesterday I was talking to Carol Nolte, who works with crafts here. She's just finished an internship. She's going to become a minister soon. And she's so good with crafts, and so I asked her, did you do any of this on internship? I said, can you see it involved in your ministry in any way? Oh yes, she said, I did this with some women's groups. And I said, did you experience that ministry happen through it? And she said, oh yes. She said, while we were doing it, all kinds of things came out from this group. I experienced real ministry by listening and responding to people while we did crafts. And then she said an interesting thing. I just have to tell you this at the end. She said, I included it in my
my report to the church council, and she said the men acted like, well, you know, that wasn't very important.
She said they didn't know what all I knew about their wives and them too.
So using opportunities in an unorganized way, but wherever they crop up, you're saying. I think that's probably the biggest way the church can be involved.
Well, I should also continue by saying that a problem arose in my own life that I needed some listening. And I was able to express it to that group of women in a way that I wasn't able to say it to my family. And through the healing that came about there for me, I found a new relationship with not only with the Lord, but with people.
I think that's an interesting thing that you've touched on, and that is that, and I've certainly experienced it, or I should say our family has, that when you've got something within family, sometimes you really need an outside person. Probably one of the big things in our marriage that has been a problem is in-laws. And when Herb and I would get really disgusted with each other sometimes, I would call him Ruth and he would call me Jess. Can you guess who those two people were? Oh, did that hurt? That was the cruelest thing we could do to each other. Because in both cases, it was the parent that we had the biggest conflict with in growing up. See? So it was really laying something bad on each other. Well, you get in kind of a rut in dealing with those in-law things, for instance, if they're difficult sometimes, and you really need a third person who is outside of the emotional track. I think that's what you're saying. And by reflecting, you can really break through. And so it's no put down to need an outside person. I mean, if you need it, just go get it. That's a smart thing to do. And I'm certainly not ashamed of having needed that. And it, you know, you might think, oh, you're a health caregiver and a clergyman. You know, you should be able to solve your own problems. That's why we get into trouble, because we keep saying we can solve them ourselves. But when you break through that and say, yeah, I need some help, that's a neat thing to be able to do.
And that's a giving thing, too, because that reassures someone else who may be timid about opening up to you that you need their listening, and they're much more open to opening up to you because you've shown that it's all right to do that.
To be a little vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I
want
to tell you just a preliminary before I tell you about the adventures that I had been in a lot of counseling from, I was 18 to 35, maybe. And I found that the best counseling that I had after about 13 psychiatrists and stuff was where someone actually touched me. That was the beginning of healing. And we have a group in our church that started out as a prayer group, and the leader in it is just very gifted in caring about people, so he makes a really good leader. And it's a caring, sharing, it's actually a prayer group, but it's kind of a caring, sharing group. And because he's gifted as a leader in touching people, he sets a stage for prayer, and when he sets the stage, he just said with anything that is said here is left here. And he encourages us, it's men and women, and he encourages us to ask, petition for stuff, for things for ourselves first, and maybe thanking prayers. And it's a group where, I don't know, I've been in groups before, but there's just not one like that, and it's because there's a lot of touching too. And because he sets the stage before, there's never any feeling that you want to go tell somebody else sometime about someone's problem there. And it's just such an open group. It starts around 8 o'clock, and it goes till 10:30 sometimes. There's a lot of healing there, more healing, I think, than when you're in counseling. I don't know why, except I think it's the touching and actually hearing that someone knows you and really knows your ups and your downs and the good part about you, share the good part about you, the bad part about you, and they still care about you. And that's all really, I think it's a really human thing.
Do you see that as being enabling them to go out and be more caring to others?
Right, and I realize the importance of touching other people who may not get touched.
Except
I'm not a good listener.
That is, touches on another principle, I think, that a group that nurtures each other well is going to send those persons out to nurture others. And so that's something we really need to do, I think, within the church, is to nurture one another and to accept the failures and faults of one another. That's something else that I think...
It helps you to accept your own failures and faults when you know that someone knows them and doesn't care.
And then you can accept others who have failures and faults, right?
My next door neighbor lost her husband last fall. Been ill 3 years with cancer. And she's just a middle-aged woman. But she says the hardest thing she goes through is going to church. It's those nice people at Trinity. They come up and put their arms around me and I have the worst time. It's just terrible, she says. They just leave me alone or just talk to me. Casually, just pass the time of day. But to give me all that sympathy, she said, I don't need it.
Now that's the thing. I was wondering if what the thing was, but there you're saying it now. It's a sympathy.
I find this very helpful to mutual understanding if you get a group together and, well, just a very brief Bible study or a verse or something like that to get started. And then everybody take part praying audibly. I found that among the Africans as well as here in America that it draws them together. If they feel that they can expose their inner self in whatever they say in prayer, it draws them together. And that means mutual help.
Mm. Prayer fellowship.
Well, that's what that group is essentially.
I'd often thought, in a crisis situation, we've just gone through a crisis, and the people that seem to help you the most are those that have gone through a similar crisis. I mean, when you're going through a crisis, you feel total isolation, that you walk down the street and you think, they don't know what I'm feeling. But someone who has gone, like the death of a husband, or someone who's going through cancer or anything, If you can talk to someone that has gone through it or is going through it, you find out your feelings aren't so way out. There's just more consolation in dealing with people who've gone through it, who can feel empathy.
So you're talking about probably support groups or at least one or two other people that you can talk with.
Right, if you could just have like a food bank in the church, you know, so-and-so is going through this crisis, could you go talk to them?
And that reminds me of a model. I was at a conference on holistic health not long ago and ways that the church can work with them. One of the best models there, at least it seemed to me that was one of the best, was called St. Stephen's Ministry. Have any of you heard of that or seen it in action?
There's a class starting in Kansas City in August, a two-week class.
That's where they have them.
And we're going to send at least two back to be trained, who will in turn train others.
Do you want to tell, do you know something about it? Or
It's a lay involvement in all the caring ministries, counseling and hospital work and the whole business. We also have a diaconate program that's kind of a pilot in the ALC through Trinity Lutheran and PLU that does much the same thing. It's training people for the same thing. Does the LCA have that sort of thing with a school of theology as well as an arm that is an adjunct that is in a ministry? In other words, a serving form? Is there...
Clinical care.
Yeah, there's clinical pastoral education for the pastors. But you're talking about something for lay people.
Yeah.
This St. Stephen's thing is not limited to any certain group of Lutherans.
anybody can go through.
No, it cuts across, I guess, yes.
But one of the neat things that they have built into that system, they have somebody that goes to learn the system and then to bring it back. And the way that they begin it is to get interested people. But they try to find out in the congregation people that have had have gone through certain kinds of crises, like, for instance, the death of a child, a very, very difficult experience, as I understand it, or a divorce, or, like you say, cancer. And then when you hit one of these problems in the congregation, you know who those resource persons are, and it's a little bit like the AA system, I believe, where you combine people, you know, to be support for one another. And but they don't go out cold. They go through a training process that carries with them some learning of some of those kinds of principles that I was talking about, learning how to listen, for instance, and how to affirm people, how to support someone and to be a friend through it, through the crisis.
I think first of all, before we go into who can help someone else, is the fact that the person that's going through the crisis has to have a sounding board. You just don't get up in church one Sunday and raise your hand and say, hey, I've got a problem. In fact, you wouldn't dare do that. And so the type of group that she was talking about, the knitting and the other group. Now, I found my greatest healing in a women's group that was an interdenominational Bible study. And yes, we had a lesson plan, and we had, you know, we had a certain thing to do. But it was the deepest group that I could come and share anything in my life. And it was just a miracle that someone else in that group had just the answer. I could go there just believing that it became so intimate and so such a sounding board group that every time I came back from there, just lifted, and my problem was already beginning to be solved in my own mind.
Small groups then.
And I think that the sounding board, the fact that if you have a crisis, that you have some place where you can get up and say, hey, I have this crisis, and be honest with you, and then they can react to that. Because otherwise, if no one, you know, you could have all the resource people out there in the world in your congregation. If you didn't have a sounding board, then it would be of no use.
Yes, and I think it's like you said a minute ago, that when you're going through a crisis and you're keeping it all to yourself, you begin to feel more and more weird, and that nobody has ever felt this way before. And to just be able to share it with somebody is really a neat thing.
Here's, I think, a growing popularity of men's groups, too. And just after the women's group type thing started to come to the forefront, then the men started to get together and felt the need for them to share on an intimate level. And that in our society has been something that is sort of, it has been a no-no, that men don't share intimate personal things with one another because it shows a sign of weakness. So I think this is something that's on the upswing now too, a healthy thing.
I think too that in bygone days when families were not as mobile as they are now, perhaps relatives were more support, but many of us are far away from relatives where we live and do not have that kind of support. And I think that lends to a more of an isolation in crisis, because families can be an enormous support.
Out of a church, you have a membership of, say, 1,000. How many of them are, say, hypothetically, that would be going to church and be active in everything in church? What, 500? 600 maybe?
Yeah.
Okay. Then the other 400, I haven't heard anybody say anything about the other 400.
That's an interesting point.
And what you have, the other 400, are the Sunday worshiper. And if you don't have something for he or she, like say you have your service from 11 to 12, and everybody greets them at the door, and then the minister stands at the door and shakes their hand and say goodbye. I've gone through that for for a number of years, and then people, if you don't have something after 12 o'clock, you see, between say 12 and 12:30, for a person to maybe express themselves to somebody and say they're holding something within themselves, and they don't want to.
Do you have anything in mind that could solve that in some way?
I think every church should have something after 12 o'clock so that the congregation that's there, maybe you might have 25% of the congregation that hasn't showed up for, say, 3 Sundays. And you say, well, gee whiz, why is it that Joe Smith hasn't been here? But nobody has really dubbed into it, or nobody's actually called John Smith or gone over and knocked on his door or anything like this. So this is something that the church, I think, is lacking. That extra half an hour on Sunday, or even 20 minutes, as far as I feel, will say. That coffee 20 minutes, you know, that the other 75% gets to know the 25% that isn't normally there.
We had that in our church. It's about a half an hour. They set up right in the foyer of the church, set up a coffee room, and there's, you know, different committees that offer to do it. Cookie and coffee, and yeah. Well, everybody stands around top for at least
I think
an
it's
hour,
necessary
even
every Sunday, not once a month.
No, we do
now,
every
I
Sunday.
See. I see a lot of churches, they'll have it just once a month. That's wrong. If you're going to have it once a month, you should have it every Sunday, because that brings your congregation closer together.
Is there anything that we could do with our liturgy that could be more of a healing kind of an experience regularly?
I'm just talking about every week instead of once a month.
Okay.
It's a good opening.
What's that, sir?
The sacraments every month.
Every week. We have it every week now in home, man. What the goings on? Fighting and struggling all over the place. I'm like it. I'm going to.
No healing, huh?
No. I mean, and then you get the feeling, the ones that aren't for it, you know, so then they sit like this that Sunday that they are not going to go.
This isn't really on the liturgy, but I think you know, we're hitting from different angles the problem that the church has in being this kind of listening community. I think the church, as it's geared up and as it happens, like you said, is more geared up to be speaking out and giving and proclaiming, and I think people in church leadership positions are more geared up to be talking than listening. And one thing that strikes me about Christian education is that Christian education does not listen to people.
That's true.
And I heard she happened to be Jewish, but she was talking about religious education as it's perceived at her synagogue or at her support group or whatever, and was talking about the notion of not telling kids when they're wrong. And I guess that's very foreign to the way I come at it. You know, when I'm teaching confirmation, I ask my questions in such a way that kids will come up with the right answer. And I think even before confirmation, in preschool and in grade school, Sunday school, kids learn a certain story. And they learn it in such a way that they can recite it back, that when they give the answers to the questions, they're right. And, you know, when people say, and who died on the cross for us? Jesus did. And everyone can say it, you know. And she was talking about the way that she never tells her kids when they're wrong. And she told about a story she was telling where, and I think probably a lot of you have heard this story, where God is walking along in the sand next to this person, and after he's dead he looks and sees these two pairs of footprints in the sand. And when he was having big problems, he sees only one set of footprints in the sand, and he asked God, "Why? Where were you when I was having these problems?" And he says, "I was carrying you." She told this story to her kids, or two kids, and I'm not even sure what age they were, but they're young kids, and one said, well, no, that couldn't be, because God doesn't walk anyhow. God floats. And she said, I had to stop myself from saying, no, that's wrong. You're missing the point of the story. And her other kid said, no, you're wrong. God isn't invisible. He doesn't exist. And she said, once again, I had to stifle myself. And I don't think there's very many people who could stifle themselves and not correct them and say, no, you're wrong, God doesn't exist, you know, and just really stop that kid cold and tell him, you're wrong, God exists. But there was a young kid trying to say something that they thought about God and picking the wrong words. But I think we, you know, and it wouldn't be that important to correct a five-year-old on that point or something like that. I think we're so concerned about getting our theology right and getting our words across in the right way that we don't listen as a whole as a church. And maybe Christian education would be another way that we could.
There's a book by Merton Strumman called The Five Cries of Youth. And he says in this book that you can almost separate a youth group into, you know, categories of where they're crying out. Mm-hmm. And I've been involved with a youth ministry group, which is a relational ministry, and they're... their thing is to go out into congregations and listen. Listen to the questions of youth. And ultimately, those questions are mostly religious questions. If you'll press those questions on and keep them coming, they end up being religious questions. A real search for meaning in life and to be rid of this guilt of, you know, not being worth anything or have without meaning. And I think that's true more not only for youth. It's true for all of us that there are basic questions that we come up with, and they're ultimately questions of God. And if we listen long enough, we'll hear those. Is there anybody else that has?
I would say you were discussing liturgy, and you know I've been raised in the Christian church, I mean the Lutheran church and everything, and the liturgy is really important to me, but. You take people that are coming into the church and they're searching for something. And particularly if they're from some other faith, you know, and they just walk in church. And then if you have this long lengthy, they have a real hurting problem, and they have this long lengthy liturgy, and they're waiting for the sermon because maybe in the sermon they'll hear something that they want to hear. And if that means that because you have all this liturgy, that the sermon is going to be shortened, and it's not going to be word for you today, then I feel that, you know, that's a hurting situation.
But my intention when I said liturgy was the creative things that we might do with liturgy to make it really be a healing for all of us, and to help us to be on the same level. We're all sinful and in need of God's help, no matter what our particular things are. And to see ourselves on one level, all needing to God to increase our faith and to cover our sins and to be one, really one in Christ. Let's do all we can to learn communication skills. I think that's a basic. And to keep close to the Lord ourselves and try to learn how to be more sensitive to one another in our work, wherever we go, not only inside of the church, but in God's world. Just some closing thing you want to say?
It's kind of deep, so I'll ask you about later.
Oh. Okay. God bless you in your ministry. Every one of you are ministers.
No, I don't.